This video is sponsored by Campfire Technology, who want to share their upcoming software, Campfire Blaze, funding on Kickstarter right now. More on that later. We've talked about bad guys before. Evil emperors, fallen heroes, pure evil villains, those grand, glorious antagonists that rule with fists of iron and capes of stylishness. But who remembers the villainous proletariat? Who speaks for those working-class villains, the cogs in the evil machine that keep the whole evil engine firing on all its evil cylinders? Who remembers the minions? Not those minions. Don't even think about it. So today, let's pay homage to evil minions, those unappreciated bastions of evil society that take care of all the dirty work to keep things running on the ground while the evil boss is up in the high tower dangling protagonists off cliffs or monologuing to stormy skies. Now, the trope of the evil minion is, at heart, representative of a very simple dynamic. Servitude. A villain serving another villain. The simplicity of this mechanic allows for cascading chains of minions, villains serving other villains, serving even bigger villains. While heroes often form loose, ragtag bands of misfits built on found family and friendship, villains like a chain of command. It's not uncommon to learn that your Season 1 villain was actually serving an even scarier Season 2 villain the whole time, or that your evil emperor is actually carrying out the will of an evil god of some sort. Because of this simple fact, almost any character can be a minion, including full-fledged pure evil villains. All they need is a minion motivation. Why does this character serve a villain? Well, while there's a lot of leeway here, broadly the answer tends to fall into one of these categories. Loyalty, money, common or personal goals, fear, love, and coercion. Loyalty's the easy one. Sometimes the minion is just loyal to the villain for whatever reason. Maybe they're old friends, maybe the villain saved them from a bad situation and now they've got a life debt thing going, maybe it's not even explained. Whatever. Minions that are actually loyal to the villain are very valuable because they almost never turn good, which is a major risk for evil minions. If a minion doesn't obviously display another minion motivation, you can presume it's this one. Basically, the default baseline as well as being the most reliable motive. Loyalty is hard to deliberately instill, so truly loyal minions should be valued by the villain. But if they aren't, sometimes the minion's loyalty will crack or something else will supersede it and they'll turn on the bad guy anyway. There's also a slight difference between personal loyalty and ideological loyalty. The minion might be loyal to the villain specifically, or they might be loyal to the cause the villain represents. Both are good, the first is slightly less likely to betray the villain right when they finally achieve their ultimate victory. Also, if this loyalty is built on a lie of some kind, the minion is liable to turn on the villain the minute they find out, so this might not be worth the risk. Money is another easy one. Some minions work for pay. Shocking, right? These minions serve their villain as mercenaries because they're professionals and it's what they do. Money-motivated minions, if they come in a group, frequently form what is known as a quirky mini-boss squad, as they will each typically possess an area of expertise that allows them to each provide a unique challenge when they inevitably fight the heroes. It's like the evil version of a five-man band. These minions are often stronger and more competent than the average minion, which is why the villain is willing to actually pay for their services instead of just paying them and not killing them today. However, as their motivation is entirely financial, these minions stand a strong chance of switching sides if the heroes provide enough incentive. Also, sometimes a minion is working for pay, but is actually motivated by something personal, like find and battle strong opponents or hurt people for fun. This isn't technically a financial motivation and instead falls under the purview of the next category, common or personal goals. Sometimes the minion has their own thing going on, and working with the villain will help them with that. These minions are volatile because they have personal priorities over the villain's priorities, and if it looks like those priorities might no longer align, they might split. Villains hate this, so personally motivated minions might not live too long after the split unless they get scooped up by some passing good guys. This minion has no direct loyalty to the villain, but because of that, these minions are typically top tier because the only reason the villain would keep this volatile minion around is because they do good work. Personally motivated minions also stand a strong chance of spiraling off into their own character arc if they successfully slip away from the villain. But in order to keep these volatile minions in line, sometimes the villains will supplement their personal motivation with the next category, fear. Villains love this one because it's easy. If the villain's got the oomph to pull it off, it's not hard to keep minions in line through fear. It's only stable for as long as the villain is fearsome, though, and if the villain loses that for some reason, they might start hemorrhaging minions. This one is also useful because it can easily supplement other motivations. Maybe the minion is ideologically loyal to the villain, but if that cracks, they're still too afraid to break rank. This is frequently how the villain keeps the grunt minions in line. Any minion that fears the villain is by default less impressive than a minion with personal gravitas that treats the villain more like a peer or a respected superior. But if an actually scary villain is genuinely afraid of the villain they serve, that definitely boosts the fearful factor. Now, love. This one's complicated. Sometimes a minion loves the villain, and whether or not the villain loves them back, they'll still do what they want. Sometimes the villain actively encourages this by sort of leading them on, or in some cases going full-on abusive parent or partner, manipulating or gaslighting the minion by leveraging that love. These minions are usually tragic figures, especially in the cases where the villain is someone like a parent who really should love them and value of their life, but doesn't. In terms of skill level, these minions are generally mid-tier. The villain keeps them around because they're unrelentingly loyal, not because they're the best of the best. If the minion goofs up enough, the villain might decide it's time for them to go, which is always a very tragic moment when the minion in love realizes that the villain only indulged them because they were useful. And finally, coercion. Sometimes, to keep a minion in line, the villain needs some kind of leverage. Blackmail and brainwashing might be involved. This is usually restricted to very valuable minions the villain really wants to keep around for whatever reason. These minions will split at the first opportunity and will frequently try and take out the villain themselves. A risky play, but some minions are really worth the trouble. But this does bring up the question, why does the villain even bother to have minions? In universe, the reasons are usually pretty simple. Minions get odd jobs done, they broaden what the villain is capable of, they make it easier to accomplish wide-scale villainy, stuff like that. But there are also major narrative benefits the writer might find very useful. For one, finding out that the villain who's been giving you so much trouble is actually just the small potatoes minion to a much bigger villain is a good way to escalate the stakes, though this does actually depend on why the minion villain follows this broader scope villain. If they're just loyal to their cause, that doesn't actually tell you anything about the villain they serve. But if the broader scope villain is keeping the minion villain in line through fear, that suggests they're a much bigger threat to your heroes than the minion villain was. Another big benefit of minions is they diversify the villain's evil portfolio. One villain can really only do so much, but an entire villainous chain of command can have a lot of specialized bad guys on the payroll. And of course, since the key to a successful evil venture is delegation, it makes sense that your boss villain would want to find the right minion for the job. Maybe your heroes need hunting down by a super persistent silent assassin, or an enemy government needs infiltrating by a shape-shifting master manipulator, or you just need your biggest, dumbest minion to go punch a hole in something. A villain shouldn't be expected to do everything themselves, it's demeaning, and they've got better, more important things to do. In fact, the mere existence of a villain's minions communicates very clearly to the audience that the villain does have more important things to do than tangle with the heroes whenever they pop up to cause trouble. There's a lot to be said for a villain who has higher priorities than fighting the heroes. Kind of shakes up the assumption that the heroes are the center of the story. So throwing in a posse of specialized evil minions to take care of delegated villainy really helps get across that this is a villain with their act together and their own thing going on. But that's not the only benefit. See, because of the role they play in the story, villains often get a little flattened in the characterization department. They're defined by their dynamic with the heroes, which is usually pretty simple. They're an antagonist. They oppose the heroes. There's room for nuance, but not all that much. But this can be counterbalanced by showing us how the villain interacts with people they don't ideologically oppose. A villain's dynamic with their minions can show us who they really are, outside the moral dichotomy that makes up the hero-villain conflict. And this can be a very juicy source of characterization. For example, let's look at Fire Lord Ozai from Avatar The Last Airbender. On paper, this guy is a pretty standard issue evil overlord. He's trying to conquer the world and or burn it to the ground. He's got a fleet of zeppelins, an army of faceless minions, a sinister cape, and a very fetching hairdo. He's not even fully seen on screen for 41 episodes, and even after that, we basically only see him either getting ready for war or hucking fireballs at Aang. He's basically a non-entity in the character department, except for the fact that every important aspect of his character can be inferred from his dynamic with his children, Zuko and Azula, who both spend at least some of the series serving Ozai in a minion capacity. Long before we ever meet Ozai, we learn exactly what kind of father he is when Iroh tells us how Ozai publicly mutilated his own teenage son for objecting to a tactical decision that would have resulted in the loss of an entire division of new recruits. This little tidbit already speaks volumes about his character, but the more we learn about Ozai and Zuko's dynamic, the worse it gets. The condition Ozai sets for Zuko's return is the capture of the Avatar, and at the time he gave him that mission, the Avatar had been missing, presumed dead, for nearly a century. Zuko took it very seriously, but Ozai was clearly sending him off on an impossible fool's errand that'd keep him disgraced in an exile until he managed to get himself killed picking a fight with whatever vastly superior benders he encountered on the way. It's very obvious that Ozai couldn't care less about his son, and even when Zuko is allowed to return to the Fire Nation, Ozai acts like nothing happened and barely interacts with him. We already know we should hate this guy full seasons before we ever see him purely because of the impact he had on Zuko, and it's only made worse when we meet Azula, the other byproduct of Ozai's stellar parenting, whose upbringing has left her with a fascinating cocktail of issues that a psychologist might refer to as a piping hot mess. Thanks to Ozai, Azula believes that the only thing in life that matters is control, and thus she struggles in every single social interaction, either trying to maintain an iron grip on the situation or completely falling apart when things don't go her way. Because if things aren't going her way, it means she's failing, and if she's failing, that makes her a failure, just like Zuko. The most terrifying thing she can think of is being treated by her father the way he treats her brother. Azula is a terrifying weapon of war, but she's also a lonely 14-year-old with a ton of issues and no concept of healthy social relationships. Where Zuko had developmental help in the form of his mother, Uncle Iroh, and the good guy gang to help pry him out of his shell and give him some sense of personal worth, Azula just had the transactional approval of her distant father and her girl posse, and she had to coerce those two into helping her out, which of course made perfect sense to her control-centric worldview, but also made it very easy for them to turn on her when they got priorities more important important than fearing her. And in the finale, we even see that Ozai discards her the minute his personal goals are in reach. He crowns her Fire Lord and then grounds her at home while he crowns himself super cool God Emperor of everything and takes off on his blimp to burn the world down. He wants this victory to be only his, and he wants it to be absolute, so he gives his most loyal minion a token participation ribbon and immediately invalidates it by pulling the rug out from under her new title and abandoning her to take the win for himself. Ozai's dynamic with his children speaks volumes about his character and makes him stunningly easy to hate, despite how little of his character we actually see on screen. But giving us a good minion-villain dynamic doesn't always serve to make the villain extra hateable. In some cases, it actually foreshadows that the villain might not be all that bad. Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood gives us a pretty good example that's a bit of a spoiler, so skip ahead if you're dodging those, when our heroes meet the homunculus Greed. Now, this happens pretty early on, but at this point, we've already seen a number of homunculi. We know they're themed around the Seven Deadly Sins, they work for this spooky mystery man, and they are extremely evil. They're largely unkillable, with unique body horror powers, and they've got some kind of evil plan we're not privy to yet. At this point in the story, we don't fully know what they want or who all of them are, but the ones we've seen have no qualms about torturing, killing, and in one case, eating random humans. They're bad, is what I'm saying. But then, one of our heroes gets kidnapped by the homunculus Greed, who's pretty affable, if utterly self-centered, and he happens to have a merry band of misfit chimeras on his payroll. Now, Greed is definitely an antagonist, but he's not working with the other homunculi, and his dynamic with his minions is actually very chill. He claims he likes them because they're his possessions, and as a personification of Greed, he obviously likes everything he owns, but it's pretty clear that his posse has a bit of a, sure boss, whatever you say, attitude towards this particular explanation. They're all very loyal to him, and basically all die sacrificing their lives for him shortly thereafter, when their secret base is attacked by the homunculus Wrath. Greed is, in turn, deeply upset at the loss of his minions. Just because they were his, you know, totally greedy, definitely didn't actually like them as people, he swears, and despite his creepy powers and his technical antagonist status, it's still pretty obvious that this is a guy who cares very deeply about the people in his life. Greed's dynamic with his minions shows us very early on that he's not like the other homunculi and that he actually cares about the people close to him, and this in turn hints that maybe he's not quite as ironclad in his villainy as the others. This is confirmed sometime later when he gets reborn without any memory, allegedly as a proper villain this time, then encounters and kills the sole survivor of his old minion troop and is immediately overwhelmed by sudden incredible guilt and pain, and by way of an explanation is helpfully informed by the person whose body he's currently inhabiting that he just killed a friend, that despite the memory wipe he can never truly forget his friends because those friends are a part of his soul. And if nothing else, his guilt and pain proves that they were more than just possessions to him. Immediately after this disturbing revelation, Greed becomes a full-on good guy. If your villain treats their minions well, it's a good indicator that they're not quite as black and white in the morality department as they maybe could be. And if your villain treats their minions badly, it helps hammer home that they're a bad person who mistreats the people they have power over and doesn't reciprocate their loyalty. But even beyond the simple morality department, a villain's dynamic with their minions lets us see who they are as a person instead of just an antagonist. The Joker's dynamic with Harley Quinn shows us that beyond being a garden variety murderer with a very goofy gimmick, the Joker is a consummate manipulator who has exactly zero qualms about leveraging Harley's love for him to get what he wants. And he's also a textbook abusive boyfriend. Mad Love does more for the Joker's characterization than the entirety of The Killing Joke. Looping back to Avatar, Ozai's dynamic with his children shows us that he has a very simple, strength-based worldview that classifies compassion and love as weaknesses and power and control as the only things that matter. Ozai is also pretty clearly a narcissist who thinks his own impressive qualities are the only good qualities. Firebending talent, charismatic political power, symmetrical features, etc. This is why he lauds Azula as a poised firebending prodigy but ignores Zuko because of his comparatively unimpressive firebending, even though he demonstrates prodigious skill in almost every other form of combat. Without relying on his bending, Zuko is probably the best fighter in the series, a skill set he uses to routinely take down other benders. Basically, Ozai's an idiot for not recognizing Zuko's potential, and if he'd bothered to actually encourage Zuko's unique skill set, he could have had an incredibly effective assassin on his payroll. Also, not joking about the symmetry thing. Ozai deliberately scars Zuko only on half his face, while Azula maintains perfect symmetry in her appearance right up until her mid-finale breakdown when her Ozai-based worldview of power and control begins to crumble. Avatar is so good, you guys. So basically, a villain's dynamic with the heroes is generally kind of flat, but their dynamic with their minions can be a lot more nuanced and give us a much better understanding of their character. Minions can be just about any character, they just need a reason to work as a minion. Minions let you diversify your antagonists and present all kinds of fun characterization opportunities. They're not necessary for every good villain, but they're definitely fun and narratively quite useful. So, yeah. This video was sponsored by Blaze, a new web-based application from the creators of the world-building software Campfire. We've told you before about their tools for building story timelines, character bios, and world backgrounds, and now you can have all that and more with Blaze. It's got all the features of Campfire, with new additions like magic systems, languages, and a word processor. It's a browser-based web app where users can collaborate with others in real time, and everything will be saved on the cloud. Blaze will have a subscription-style payment system, but unlike, say, Netflix, where you pay a flat rate no matter what you watch, Blaze will only have you pay for the features that you personally need. They're currently running a Kickstarter to fund it. Those of you who already own Campfire will automatically get the benefits of Blaze when it comes out, and Kickstarter backers will receive benefits according to your support. So if any of this sounds interesting, swing by and give it a look.